I'm W.S. Thackeray, and I'm interviewing Major General Norman L. Magnuson. It's the 28th of August, 1980.
Okay, we're on, General Magnuson. If you would tell us when you were born first.
15th of April, 1918.
Okay, and what brought you into the Air Force?
Well, I suppose like a large number of people in the war. I was working in Winnipeg for Lever Brothers, the soap people, when war broke out, and joined the Reserve Army, the Winnipeg Rifles, in early 1940. It didn't take me very long to realize that the Army was not not the kind of service that I would enjoy, particularly the infantry. So I made application to the Air Force, and at that time there was a waiting list for aircrew, and I wasn't accepted for aircrew until I believe it was probably around February of 1941, and finally went to Manning Depot in the early spring of 1941.
Mm-hmm. Was that in Toronto?
No, Manning Depot in Brandon, Manitoba.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The days at Manning Depot were, as I guess, normal as they as they can be for Manning Depot. Yeah. After Manning Depot, we were sent to initial training school at Regina, where selection was made for pilot or navigator, pilot or observer in those days. I was selected as an observer. I still don't quite know why. Perhaps it had something to do with depth perception in the link trainer. However, I think a large number of us at that time felt that perhaps there was a requirement for more observers than there were pilots, and a number of us became observers.
This certainly was a problem with a lot of chaps that joined. They found themselves put where they were needed rather than where they really wanted to go, I think.
Oh, yes.
I've run into this before.
On reflection, certainly it was something that had to be done at that time.
Yeah.
The requirements had to be met. If there was a greater need for, mm-hmm. for observers, obviously they had to funnel people into that that category rather than pilot. Choice wasn't something that that one could necessarily have during the war.
Yeah.
But in any event, from the initial training school, we proceeded on to navigation school. I took my navigation training at 5 AOS, 5 Air Observer School in Winnipeg. So I did get back home. Mm-hmm. From 5 AOS, upon graduation from there, we took bombing and gunnery, a bombing and gunnery training course. At that time, we were flying ferry battles.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of an interesting airplane. I don't know whether you've interviewed anyone who's flown in the back seat of a ferry battle.
Well, I remember seeing them, and know what they're like, yeah.
It was a fairly short course. I believe it was about a 6-week course, if I remember correctly. In the winter months, at Paulson in Manitoba, or was it in Saskatchewan? It was somewhere in the prairies, anyway.
Somewhere there, yeah. They all looked the same.
Yeah, some small town in the prairies. On completion of bombing and gunnery, we took an astro-navigation course at Rivers, Manitoba. And on finishing that course, we were fully qualified as observers. An observer was a person who could navigate, who could also drop bombs, and who had some knowledge of wireless, and who could also handle a machine gun. In other words, he was a combination navigator, bombardier, wireless person, and an air gunner.
Obviously not thinking of in terms of large four-engine aircraft at that time.
No, not at all.
A crew,
no. Sort of an all-purpose second man in an airplane.
Mm-hmm. What did you carry? You had your observer wing?
An O-wing.
An
yes.
O-wing, yes.
Flying arsehole, as they used to call it. A wing I think that most of us were very proud of, because it was a very difficult course academically to complete, and difficult also from a flying point of view. The navigation in those days was pretty elementary, pinpointing, mm-hmm. astro-navigation primarily, some wireless, of course, but one had to appreciate that, that once you were in a theater of war, the wireless portion of your navigation would be denied to you through jamming, and that you would have to be able to get from point A to point B primarily on astro-navigation and whatever you might pick up in locating landmarks by pinpointing. Dead reckoning, of course, being the sort of underlying aspect of navigation. On completion of the course at Rivers, we were then, as I recall, given a short leave at home, and were put on notice that we would be sent overseas very shortly.
Excuse me, what was the proportion, would you think of the Air Force at that time, or in your boat, if you would, who were sent overseas as distinct from those who were kept in Canada, continued training future members of the Commonwealth Air Training Plan?
Oh, I would say it would be pretty hard for me to assess, because our entire course went overseas.
Ah, okay.
But in talking to people afterwards, I would say a very small percentage of the observers remain in Canada. A larger number, probably a larger percentage of pilots, because pilot training was expanding at a very rapid rate.
Yeah.
And there are more pilots required. Pilot training is more of a one-on-one situation than observer training. In observer training, you can take large classes of people and in a classroom, or large numbers of people in a classroom, and give them instruction. Whereas in pilot training, a pilot would normally not have any more than, say, perhaps three students, four at the most.
Yeah, this is at one time you're talking about training.
That's right.
Yes.
So I guess there were a larger number of pilots retained. The majority of the observers went overseas.
Had you your commission at this point?
No.
I you were a sergeant?
Graduated as a sergeant observer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we arrived overseas in the spring of 1942.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Bournemouth, I suppose, as all people do. We landed at Greenock after a rather interesting trip across in a troop ship called the Letitia. Actually, it was a pleasant trip, seven days. Little zigzagging around the sub.
In convoy, or?
In convoy,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But while we heard of some activity within the convoy, we weren't really aware of any. There were constant reports of subs in the vicinity, but I don't think anyone saw any activity. It seemed to me our convoy got through unscathed. I recall my reception in Greenock. It was tremendous. I don't know whether the Scots were aware that Canadian troop ships were disembarking at the time, but it was very early in the morning, and the station platform was crowded with people, sort of cheering, I suppose. Maybe it was a bad time in the war. I don't recall whether the spring of 42 was a particularly bad time. They seemed very happy to see us.
That's interesting, because at that point there must have been, you know, you must have been just one in a very long line of troop ships.
Of course
you
were,
and they still had this feeling towards
you. They still came out to greet us, and seemed to be so pleased that the Canadians were coming to their assistance. I can't remember that same sort of feeling in Bournemouth. We arrived in Bournemouth and stayed there for some time. Bournemouth was our reception depot. I suppose perhaps the people in that part of the UK are somewhat different. A number of retired people who had been through a war before were probably, I don't know, a little bored with the number of foreigners they had in their midst, particularly Canadians and Australians and New Zealand troops. We stayed in Bournemouth, I believe, about 6 weeks, and then went on to what was called an advanced flying school in Dumfries in Scotland, where we flew Anson aircraft. And rather interestingly, all of the pilots, instructor pilots on the Ansons, were Poles.
Really?
Who had escaped from Poland. And we did most of our training and exercises over the Irish Sea, over Northern Ireland and Scotland. Navigation in Ansons and the kind of weather they had in that part of the world is something that we had not experienced.
Why did you have your advanced training in the UK instead of in Canada, I wonder? Any thoughts?
I believe probably because of the availability of aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
The aircraft were available in the UK, the Anson aircraft. Maybe it was also simply a holding unit for us.
Yeah.
In other words, it was a stopgap until the operational training units could accept us. Because really, the advanced training on Anson's was simply an extension of the kind of navigation training that we received at the Air Observer School. It wasn't really advanced training. In other
words,
it wasn't
any new figure.
It was training in a different terrain situation, but certainly not new insofar as equipment was concerned. What was new was that the Polish pilots, of course, spoke very little English. It was very difficult for the observer to give them changes of course and so on. If they didn't like the course you gave them, they'd fly what the hell they wanted anyway. So you weren't really aware. You were often not aware of whether you had actually navigated the aircraft around or whether the pilot had flown it around. It was not a very useful training period. From the advanced training school in Dumfries, we were sent to the operational training unit where we began our real operational training. I joined an operational training unit at Cottesmore in County Rutland. I don't think Rutland exists anymore. I think the UK has restructured. Rutland has been absorbed in probably Lancashire.
It was a very small
county,
wasn't it?
Very, very small.
Yeah, I remember that much about it,
It was just a small corner between Lincolnshire and Lancashire.
Mm-hmm.
We flew Hamden aircraft at in Gettysburg.
What is your well, first of all, how do you spell Cottesmore?
Cottesmore.
Okay. What's your feeling about the Hamden?
Well, the Hamden was known as the flying coffin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that was borne out during our training period. We had we lost a number of crews. I can't recall how many. A number of crews. We weren't crewed up at the time, but we lost a number of aircraft. It seems to me the memories that I have of the operational training units are the difficult flights that we had. The other was carrying coffins to the cemetery. We spent a great deal of our time burying our friends.
Must have made you tend to be a little bit nervous about this aircraft.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes.
And yet they went on using them and went on building them for some
It was a very versatile aircraft.
I think they probably gave up about this time of building.
If the pilot could learn to fly it, it was a very versatile and very useful aircraft. It, in some respects, was probably ahead of its time, but it got into a stabilized yaw, and the pilot was unable to pull the aircraft out. And very often this would happen on landing. And I remember one occasion when we were waiting for night flying, getting ready to get into our aircraft. One of our group came in for a landing and crashed in front of us. And the aircraft caught fire almost immediately. And the fire crew, the crash crew, couldn't get at the pilot and the observer. And we could see them, they were right there. They were just a few feet away and screaming and in front of us.
Yeah. About shattering,
We thought they might call off night flying that night, but they didn't. We had to take off a few minutes later. But it was shattering, yes. And of course there was always this fear because you really didn't know your pilots. You had no confidence in your pilots. They were all young people.
You hadn't worked as crews at this time.
No. They were newly graduated people as well who had very little experience in the aircraft. And you were always changing pilots. You always had a different person because the idea was that you would fly with as many of the pilots as possible. They would fly with as many of the observers as possible. And then afterwards, you'd decide among yourselves whether there were someone there that you were that you wished to fly with.
Yeah, interesting, the point you made that the firefighting couldn't get close to the crew.
The fire was so intense that
What sort of equipment did you have for firefighting in those days?
I've often thought of that. Certainly they wouldn't have, I guess, the kind of suiting that we presently have.
Or the foam, perhaps?
They did have suits. I'm not sure about foam. I think they did have foam.
At that time.
Yeah.
I wonder just whether it was sort of...
I think the problem was that they simply just couldn't get close enough to the aircraft to be effective.
Heat was too...
It started so quickly and spread so quickly, and then I guess it must have been the danger of explosion, the gas tanks exploding, which did happen. But...
there were no such things in those days as large trucks with turrets that you could just...
No. They simply went out in a crash truck with their fire extinguishers,
sort of
mostly handheld, as I recall.
Yeah.
And
really quite primitive in that sense.
In this case,
Just
couldn't cope with the fire. I think they did the best they could, but there was nothing. There was no hope for these people anyway. They were trapped in the aircraft.
There's no way, of course, in those aircraft coming out through the pilot compartment at all. You came out through
no,
the door. Isn't
no, no.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, what you had to do in the aircraft was the navigator sort of sat behind the pilot, but to conduct most of his navigation, he had to go under a sort of a little tunnel underneath the pilot.
Or you went into the nose and dropped your bombs and took your drift sights and so on.
It was an interesting period. I think it was a maturing period for most of the young air crew, both pilots and navigators. They began to realize that that war was a pretty serious business. Prior to that time, it was a great deal of fun. Learning how to fly, being involved in flying activities was simply great fun. The academic aspect of it was probably boring, but once one became airborne, it was enjoyable. So I guess the operational training unit was the sort of first test of the individual's ability to cope in a war situation.
How long were you there?
We were there for 2.5 to 3 months,
mm-hmm.
all told. 3 months. I guess it must have been close to 3 months. While we were there, we had an interesting happening. We had a strike. The air crew went on strike.
Were they all Canadian or just
no,
mixed?
No, it was a mixed group of Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders. And the reason this sit-down occurred, I guess it was more of a sit-down than a strike, and it was initiated by the Australians and supported by the Canadians and New Zealanders. And it was all because of the food that was being served. It had nothing to do with flying or the dangers of flying, which one would have expected might concern them. But the food was so awful. And I guess the Australians and Canadians and New Zealanders had been used to better fare in their messes than the RAF served.
Of course, this was an RAF station, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
And you were not on Canadian rations, of course.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. No.
No.
We were on RAF rations. Mm-hmm. It was well organized in the sense that that the students simply refused to fly. Attended all the classes, but refused to fly. Mm-hmm. But it didn't last long. I believe it lasted a day or maybe perhaps 2 days. And the commanding officer called a parade and said that we were all under close arrest and we'd better grow up soon and understand that there was a war on. And they would try to do something about the food, and that sort of, I think the more sensible people in the student body soon.
Because even if the food was...
Stop the insurrection.
Even if the food was reasonable, you can certainly get cooks that can,
yeah.
can screw
yeah.
it up and nothing flat anyway.
Yeah.
But
it was something that surprised the RAF. It was something that had never occurred, I'm sure, on an RAF base before.
What sort of rations were you getting?
Well, I guess we were getting the normal rations, but...
Well, consisting of what? I mean, a lot of
meat.
A lot of sawdust sausages, and that sort of thing?
Sawdust sausages. I guess what I... it was about that time that I stopped having breakfast, I guess.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The normal fare in the morning was stewed kidneys on toast. And you could smell this stuff as you approached the mess. And it was, it was something to turn your stomach to begin with. I like kidneys.
Like stewed?
Not the way they were cooked, and of course, I guess the general cleanliness of the mess hall was something to be desired.
Were they civilian cooks or Air Force cooks at that point?
There were a mixture of civilian cooks, and I would think the cooks were probably civilians and assisted by Air Force people.
You were prepared to believe all you'd ever heard about the quality of English cooking, were you?
No, absolutely.
At that point?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
But
well, I suppose it was that you were short of eggs and that sort of thing.
Oh, we had no eggs at all.
No.
No.
Didn't they? No.
And no milk. which I suppose all young fellows or young people enjoy. Bangers and Brussels sprouts, I guess, for the main course. So it was a pretty, it was a pretty unexciting mess, and also pretty unattractive in the way it was served and so on. Nevertheless, I suppose what it did demonstrate to the Brits was that the fellows from the colonies didn't accept things quite as readily as their own people.
Did things improve?
I wonder whether they did. I suppose perhaps what we realized was that we'd be out of that place sooner or later, and our, if we delayed the course, we'd simply have to stay there that much longer. In any event, we finished OTU sometime, I guess, in the summer of, or early fall. It's been early fall, I guess, of 42. I teamed up with a young American as my pilot, a fellow called Knapp, Kingdom R. Knapp, from New York City. Don't know how we came about choosing each other as a form of crew. In fact, I recall a story he told me afterwards. We were attending a lecture on a new bomb sight, and I was fooling around with one of the other chaps in the class, and the instructor became rather annoyed because I apparently wasn't paying any attention to what he was saying, and asked me to come up and instruct the class instead. Which, according to Knapp, I did, and seemed to have more knowledge about the bomb site than the instructor. Well, I think the reason for that was that I had read about it the night before. And that Knapp decided that I'd probably be able to get him through the war. Anyway, we joined together as pilot and observer. And
your whole training at this point is still to be a two-man aircraft, two-man crew.
Two-man crew. Yeah. We didn't know where we were
going.
Yeah. We were then sent to four groups in RAF Bomber Command, and we were sent to a small base in Yorkshire called Dalton. And they were flying Wellington 1C aircraft. And it was at Dalton where we selected the remainder of our crew. We picked up a wireless air gunner, a tail gunner, and a bomb aimer, I believe, yes. Yeah, I think that's where we got our bomb aimer, at Dalton. And then shortly after, we conducted some training at Dalton, and shortly afterwards we were told that we would form a new squadron. And we formed a squadron called 428 Squadron at Dalton in November of 1942. The commander of the squadron at the time was a squadron leader, RAF squadron leader named Tubby Earl. Tubby is now a retired Air Chief Marshal. I'm going to meet him this next spring. I've been working on a project to have our squadron badge placed in St. Clement, Dean's Church in London and then contacted Tubby. So we'll meet for the first time in the many, many years. Anyhow, a sixth group, the Canadian group, was forming, and we were one of the first squadrons in the Canadian group to form.
You were under Larry Dunlap then. Were you at one point when he was at sixth group? You were only there for a short time.
Yeah, I met Larry Dunlap later. Yeah, yeah.
He was only there a relatively short time. That's why.
No, at that time. The commander of the group when it was first formed was a fellow named McEwen, Black Mike McEwen, as the Air Vice Marshal, and his number two was Roy Slemon. Roy was an Air Commodore at that time. We started operations in February of 1943 with 428 Squadron. Which was really at the height, I guess, of the bombing operations in Germany. Now, prior to that, I should go back a bit, I guess. We did take part. I took part in a 1,000 bomber raid from the OTU on Hamden with one of the instructors.
Good gracious! I mean, they sent those aircraft on these big raids, didn't they?
The first 1,000 bomber raids were. They didn't have enough aircraft, so they took the OTU aircraft as well as the.
Idea that bombers aircraft. Could fly that far or carry enough to get there and to make any difference.
Yeah. And that was my first experience. I remember the instructor wondering whether I'd get him there or not, but we did. But it was.
Where was that on? That was,
this was on Essen, and it wasn't. It wasn't too bad, really. Certainly, our trips afterwards were much, much more difficult. I think the Germans were a little surprised. They didn't expect. They didn't expect large-scale raids, and as a result, hadn't really formed their defenses for that kind of. Raid. There was a lot of flak, but the fighters were, if there were fighters, we weren't aware of them. It wasn't, the first trip really wasn't much of an experience, or at least I didn't think it was.
That was lucky, because I wouldn't have classed the Hampton in an aircraft that could defend itself very well.
The Hamptons were a damn good bomber aircraft because it was a little faster, you see, than the old at that time the Whitley and the Manchester. The Whitley was
Whitley was old, of course.
A terrible thing. Flew in a sort of nose down attitude, didn't have any speed at all. The Hamden was a sleek, maneuverable airplane for its time. Its only difficulty was that it took a skilled pilot to fly. And most of the pilots at that time probably had, well, maybe 250 hours of flying experience, which is not a heck of a lot of flying experience when you consider the conditions under which you were flying. So I would guess that maybe the Hamden got a bad name because of the lack of skill and people flying it rather than that the aircraft had any particular flaws. It was a difficult airplane to fly, but it was I think a better airplane than most of those that were available at the time. The Wellington was a different kind of an aircraft. It was much larger. A forgiving airplane, in that I think a pilot could make mistakes and get away with it in the old Wellington, where perhaps wouldn't get away with it in the Hamden. But we had our first crash landing in shortly after we joined the squadron and in Wellington. We were coming in from a night training trip, and there was a strong crosswind, and we couldn't get lined up on the runway. We just bloody well couldn't line it up on the runway. We were coming
in. Side-slipping a bit, where you were going
silent? Side-slipping.
Yeah.
So finally, we got to the point where we were short on fuel, so we decided to crash land. But again, through inexperience more than anything else, the pilot tried to land with his wheels down rather than up. And we poked one wheel through the fuselage on one side and came to a screaming halt. No one was injured, but we were certainly frightened.
Yeah, I'll bet. Was this grass runway or
we landed on the grass. No, on the grass.
You had you didn't
there was
have
a macadam runway.
It was,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we missed the runway.
Yeah.
But he as a result got a red endorsement in his logbook
mm-hmm.
for this and the dressing down from Tubby Earl and his troops. But again, it was an indication of the level of experience of the crews. The pilot just simply didn't have enough experience to know what to do in a strong wind situation. And I think perhaps if one were really to know, you rather wonder how many crews went missing through. They're simply pilot error rather than enemy action.
There must
certainly
have,
a number.
There must have been a number, yeah.
Certainly a number.
Tell me, what sort of an airfield was this? Did you have runways in different directions, or was it just sort of one main runway and
there were two runways.
There were two.
Yeah.
But the wind was just coming in the wrong angle.
It was simply a strong wind with a fairly good crosswind, but certainly not something that would bother, I would think, more experienced pilot,
mm-hmm.
he would be able to compensate for it. I think that Knapp, in retrospect, felt he hadn't handled it well. He probably panicked at the end and just let her down.
Yeah.
And we weren't, we didn't know each other too well as a crew. This is one of our first trips. I think later, as we became more experienced as a crew, it became a team effort, I think, when we got into difficulty. We helped each other reason it out and come to
work. In those aircraft, there was only one pilot, was there?
There was only
one co-pilot.
One pilot,
yeah.
We never had more than one pilot during the war.
Oh, didn't you? And even in the...
No, even on Lancasters and Halifaxes.
Really?
Yeah. The bomb airman usually sat up with the pilot and assisted him, or a flight engineer would assist him.
Yeah.
It depended on the pilot a great deal, where he wanted his flight engineer to position himself. But we started our operational tour, I believe, in February. I put my logbook along.
I don't know where we landed that first trip.
I think we started out rather easily. Yeah, we did a mine laying trip off Petten on the 6th of February, 1943. In those days, mine laying wasn't terribly sophisticated. We carried two 1,200-pound mines, and we used to have to go in and make a landfall on the enemy coast, and then from the landfall fly out on a descending course down to about 200 feet and drop the mine. As a result, you were very exposed to any aircraft batteries that might be on the coast, and also any flak ships that might be in the area our next trip, we went to Lorient, which is a small port in France, and bombed. And then from there on, it was pretty well, all of our trips were Germany, into places like Hamburg and Cologne and Essen and Wilhelmshaven and Duisburg, Frankfurt, Stuttgart, Mannheim, Dortmund, and so on. The Ruhr primarily, we were trying to blast the Ruhr. How successful we were, God knows. We had some very difficult trips. We had one over Cologne where we were blocked by searchlights for quite some time. Had to jettison our bombs. I hope we jettisoned them on the target.
There's really no way you could tell with all the light around, I suppose.
And we came back from that one rather badly shot up. Managed to land at, in Britain at that time, they had recovery bases, we would call them recovery bases now, on the east coast of England, the southeast coast of England. There was a place called Manston that, that if you were crippled, you could come in and crash land.
Looking at your glasses, is that normal operating procedure for that?
No, it's just a broken.
It's broken, oh, yeah. Broken. Suddenly, oh, my God. Yeah.
And I guess on that particular occasion from Cologne, we came into Manston, crash landed. This time we came in wheels up, so we broke the undercard off, but saved ourselves. There were two other trips, I guess, where we had considerable difficulty. We were on the fire raids in Hamburg. Well, there was one particular...
what year was this?
This was
year?
In 43 as well, yeah. We were shot up in a... We had by that time progressed to Lancaster. No, to... Halifax. We had completed a conversion from Wellington's. We completed 20 trips, mostly to the Ruhr on Wellington, and then converted to Halifax's.
How long did it take you to convert?
7 hours flying time.
Not much.
That's all they gave us.
Not much.
They were desperately in need of bomber crews at that time, experienced bomber crews particularly, and they didn't give us very much time.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, as a result of that, we crash landed at Halifax on our second trip. We had been to some target in Germany, I don't quite remember which one it was, and we came back in the early hours of the morning, and we had been shot up rather badly by a night fighter this time. We lost our mid-upper gunner. Our mid-upper gunner was killed. And I guess we were a little panicky and we were short of fuel. And we came into land, selected our undercart down, and nothing happened. So the routine was, in these circumstances, was that you tried to pump your undercart down.
By hand.
By hand. And, of course, I pumped like hell and nothing happened. And we decided we'd better get in because we didn't have any gas left. So we came in, wheels up, crash landed. And the flight commander of our flight came dashing out in his little van and dashed into the aircraft. In the midsection of the aircraft were locks, manual locks, and lock the undercarriage up manually, which were a responsibility of all of the crews, but particularly the flight engineer's responsibility, that when you came into the circuit, you were supposed to unlock the goddamn and simply turn a handle. And he didn't do it, and none of us thought of the goddamn manual undercarriage locks. Of course, here we wrecked the bloody airplane and damn near killed ourselves. In the circumstances, I guess they forgave us because we did have one dead crewman, and we were pretty badly shot up, I guess, for saying with that time the wind was up.
Yeah,
in the crew.
Yeah. So I think you were mentioning something about Hamburg, and I interrupted you, did I? Or were you
about
to that?
We got caught. This was while we were still in Wellington's. We were, it was a similar situation to the one at Cologne where we were coned. And we decided that we would dive out of it. And we were at 14,000 feet. We got into a spin in the old Wellington, and the Wellington was very forgiving aircraft to the pilot, but when it got into a spin, it was very difficult to get the goddamn thing out. It took an awful lot of brute strength to get it out. And the bomb aimer and the pilot were both working on trying to pull the bloody thing out. We finally pulled it out at 3,000 feet. And we realized that we had been shot up rather badly, that one engine wasn't working very well. We didn't quite know whether we were going to be able to keep it going or not. We had to throttle it back, and as a result had to throttle the other one back as well. And we had to make a decision. What should we do? Should we head straight for home, which meant going across the North Sea, or should we, follow the coast, which meant that we would be in enemy territory for a hell of a long time, susceptible to a hell of a lot of anti-aircraft fire and the fighters. Well, I guess I prevailed. I said, I can't swim, so we're not going across that goddamn North Sea. So we struggled home along the coast. We stayed down around 3,000 to 5,000 feet all the way along. We were jumped by a fighter once, but I guess he, I don't know why, he didn't persist, but he could have got us. But we made it. We again crash-landed on the coast and rolled off by the aircraft, but survived. We had another...
It's pretty hard on the nerves, isn't it? Eh?
Yeah, we had another trip which... was similar in a sense. This was a mine laying trip into Brest Harbor. And again, as I say, you had to make a landfall on the coast and then make a run into the harbor and drop your mine. The cliffs of Brest are pretty damn high, and we were running into the cliffs to make our landfall and being shot to hell with flak. And then as we descended to make our mine laying run, there seemed to be a row of flak ships. It was a beautiful moonlit night. You see everything in the harbor. There seemed to be a row of flak ships that we had to pass over. And they blasted the hell out of us, of course. And I don't know what happened, I don't know to this day whether we hit the superstructure of a flak ship or whether we actually hit the water as we were pulling out, because we were doing evasive action. One of the things that you did as soon as you hit the enemy coast, as soon as you got into flak, was to do evasive action. In other words, turn course, change height, change direction.
Sort of a corkscrew.
Yeah,
sort of
this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you were constantly moving your line of flight. And we were doing this on our run into drop our mines, and of course you're